The following is a point of view program. Opinions expressed are those of the participants.
You're listening to In Other Words. I'm Allison Mills.
And I'm Madeline Beck.
And we are journalism students at the University of Montana. And I've actually flipped open the page of a magazine here. It's something snazzy like Outdoors or National Geographic. And we see all of these beautiful pictures. And they may make me want to be there, you know, but for the moment, all I can do is look at them and enjoy them.
I mean, if I really like him, I'll even cut him out and tape him on the wall. I mean, just about everyone knows the picture of that woman with those piercing eyes and the red shawl. But how did this photographer even stumble upon her?
These pictures and stories can make us feel something, and they're just mere moments or isolated scenes. It's just a little blip. And it makes me wonder, what did the journalist who captures these moments go through to get this one defining piece? You know, what's happening behind the lens.
And so for the next hour, Allison and I will talk about how we actually decided to take the leap and go there ourselves. We went to India to report using audio. Also have with us Louise Johns and Kelsey Wardwell, both photojournalism majors at the University of Montana, who are with us while reporting out there.
So one of the things that we are hoping to do with this piece is show the behind-the-lens process. And for you guys, that works out perfectly because, I mean, you're quite literally behind the lens. Louise, you want to go first?
Sure. I loved being in the village of Moharly. That was my favorite, and just being in a place that's so raw. And I remember going, like when Kelsey and I were sitting next to each other on the bus, and when we were driving in, and we were just like, it's like sensory overload. And we're like, oh my, like seeing so many pictures. You just go to a place like that that's so colorful, and there's shapes, and there's just things happening and randomness everywhere. You turn a corner, and it's just like something so unexpected happening, and you want to have your camera so badly, and you want to just, like, you're just seeing so many pictures.
So when you got there with this visual feast of sorts, did you guys just start snapping up pictures of the first shoeless people you saw? I mean, did you just, like, jump right on in there?
I remember one of the first times Louise and I kind of went out, we brought our cameras, but we didn't use them, and it was just kind of, It was hard to balance wanting to be there in the moment and getting to know the people we were so briefly going to be around, and then also needing to, you know, produce work. And because we wanted to be taking photos all the time, but then we wanted to, like, I was wanting to build relationships with these people without just hiding my face.
Getting to know a place before you pick up your camera is so important, and no matter what kind of photography you're doing, I think, especially when you're in another country, and a country like India, people aren't used to having a camera in front of their face, and it's just out of respect for people and a place to not jump in there and immediately start getting what you need out of it. And it's our art form, but it's like we have to first be a human.
So even just the act of not snapping a few photos, is that important? I mean, what if there's something you really need to catch?
You have to be sensible and sensitive to the culture, because there are sometimes too when you need to have, you, things happen on the street and you should have your camera out because that's the way you get pictures, is by having your camera out. I think when you're working on a specific story and trying to get people to let you into their lives, that's when you really have to form those relationships and connections and trust between people. People are letting us into their lives, and that's huge. I mean, we're asking to tell a story about this place and these people.
So this is a really important stage in your process, isn't it? I mean, do you want to talk more about this?
Yeah, I mean, do you want to?
I think, I don't know if this is what you're looking for. We were traveling with a group of 25 college-age kids, and that's a challenge in itself. But I remember Anne Bigley, who just is amazing, and she has traveled all over the world and done exactly what Louise and I want to do with our lives. But I remember we had, like, sat down for dinner. We had some sort of meeting, and she's like, I don't work this hard to do my job to have you guys step into this country and put this stereotype on American people. She was like, you guys, you know, she told us to, you can't just be in these people's faces. Like, these are human beings. You need to be as civilized as you can and build these relationships and not just be these chaotic college kids.
I guess I realized, especially in telling a story abroad, that stage is one of the most important, if not the most important.
So why did you guys go there in the first place? I mean, I remember the shots and the malaria pills a little too vividly.
Oh, yeah. I remember the malaria pills and how horribly, horribly sick I got.
It was pretty brutal. She ended up having to spend most of the trip in extreme pain and or running to the bathroom every once in a while. I mean, what makes it all worth it to you guys? Why are you even going out and taking these pictures? Why couldn't you have just left most of it alone?
I felt really passionately about it, and the way that I can express that is through my photographs, and I think that's so important. You have to be passionate about what you're photographing, or at least have some kind of investment in it. You have to care, because you're trying to make people care.
I remember, we were back in Pune, and we were doing our individual stories with, like, groups of three people, and I had immediately, when we landed in India, had taken to heart the dogs there, and I was just, like, wrecked about that, that there was just all these stray dogs, and I was like, this never happens in the U.S. Like, how can these people just be letting these dogs run around and be homeless? And it was just, like, breaking my heart. And so then a couple weeks later, when we got to pick different stories to do, I was like, oh, well, I want to do a story on these dogs and find, like, a shelter that's actually doing something about it. And so me and a couple other girls that were in my group were doing this story. And we went with a translator, Diva, and she took us to this shelter that was supposed to be really great. And they were supposed to, like, we looked up their Facebook, and they were supposedly, like, an upcycled dog shelter that used all their cages out of, like, glass bottles, and old tires were, like, their beds. And it was like, oh, like, you know, they're taking care of the trash and these dogs. Like, that's so great. And immediately when we walked in, I mean, no one spoke English, and it was hard for Diva to communicate with them. But it was me and Diva and two other girls who went in, and there's just, like, 100 dogs, and they're all just, like, barking, and it just, like, obviously just smells really bad, and it was so hot, and it was just all dirt. I mean, and you kind of expect that in India, but all these dogs were in this, like, gated, it was just, like, a pretty much just, like, a fenced-in yard. We kind of got to looking around, and I was the photographer there, and I kind of, like, took a minute and was like, wow. And I kind of started looking at the dogs, and they had mange. And I remember one in particular had, it was, like, sitting against all these cartons, and it was, like, just sitting there, and it kind of, like, I don't know, it was, like, being really somber. And I looked at it closer, and it had just a gaping, bloody wound, and it just was awful. A lot of them had broken legs that obviously weren't fixed. And I remember the girls all came up to me and they're like, Kelsey, we need to leave. Like, this is not a place that we want to be. Like, we're all very uncomfortable. And I had kind of just gotten into my mode that I was like, no, I need to tell this story and I need to get this out there. I'd never been around that kind of thing before, but something just hit me that I needed to be there, I needed to do what I was doing, and I couldn't let my emotions step in the way. And then even getting back and like looking through my photos, I was like, wow, I can't believe I stayed and took a photo of that dog with no eye. And like, oh, this one dog had a missing ear and it had its whole like side of its face was gone and there was maggots in it and it was bloody. And that was definitely a time where I think I realized I was a stronger photographer than I knew I was.
But now everyone has that feeling that as soon as they are about to leave a place or as soon as they're starting to walk away, they realize there was something they didn't do, something they forgot to say or something they desperately wish they could have done but ran out of time. And now it's too late. I mean, traveling on a trip to India was no different. I felt like as soon as we started to get the hang of it, we woke up dazed and confused in the middle of a flight over the Pacific Ocean on our way home.
And there was definitely things that we could have seen or places we wish we could have gone. You know, there was that one temple that we went to, and I really wish that we could have stayed longer. There was always another trip to the shopping market that I would have loved. And I don't know, but it's the hardest thing for any reporter is walking away from a story. You know, there were amazing places and amazing people, but as a reporter, it's really hard to walk away from just that story. And it's a story sometimes that desperately needs to be told.
Michael Hannon is another reporter that was on our trip. Now, he was in Moharly, a little village we stayed at for about a week to report on a nearby tiger reserve, when he found the story he needed to tell. Unfortunately, he got to it too late.
I didn't go to report a story that I and everyone else already knows about. So I found out about the elephants one of the last days we were there. There's this family of elephants. There's a mom, a dad, the mom's sister, and a baby. It was less than a year old at the time. And they were brought there from another city in India. It's like a tourist attraction. People can go and tour the jungle on these elephants instead of in cars. And they're chained up, and it's just they just look so sad, and it's just really sad to watch. The big ones had just one chain around their back, left or right foot.
Like, remember the sounds of the chains on,
yeah.
Like it's like this booming sound. The sound of an elephant is so powerful, and then the sound of an elephant with chains on it is just heartbreaking.
Yeah, and they weren't necessarily like chained to anything or each other, but it was just like these huge heavy chains, and it was just kind of like it like slowly started sinking in that they weren't just like these free elephants, and it wasn't like an enjoyable thing to see them.
They're so gentle, like to see and hear a creature like that, an animal like that that's so beautiful and just innocent, I guess. Just to see that was so heartbreaking.
You know, they're very smart animals. It's sad to see a smart animal in captivity. So the mom and the baby were coming up to me as I was there and like putting their trunks out, like, you know, curious about me. And I think that they could see, you know, that I'm this nice guy, and they want to, like, hey, I want to get to know this guy. And then they get close to me, and they're right there, and it's like this intimate moment, and then these people just start throwing rocks at them and scaring them.
Baby would kind of, like, walk up to us, and the guy would, like, start throwing rocks at it.
And so they're backing away, and they're scared. And then there's these teenagers come rolling through who, I guess, are friends with the caretakers, and they're just, like, barking at them and just being mean.
These people were, like, they were, like, beating on them and, like, giving them commands to do things. And the elephants are actually really obedient, but you can just see, like, they look like they're crying. They just look like they have, like, Kelsey's picture is so good because it looks, you can just see, like, they look like they're crying.
I mean, I just kind of snapped a couple photos, and the one that I remember in particular is one of the mom's eye, and it's just, like, this glossed over, like, almond-shaped, beautiful eye, but it just has this, like, stream, and it looks like it's been like this coming from its like tear duct, it looks just like a stream that's happened over and over. Like it's not just like a single one. It looks like it's like a stained movement of it from crying. But I mean, it just like breaks my heart every time I see it almost. And people are like, oh, wow, that's really beautiful. But I'm like, I feel like I'm like,
I have to come back and do something about the elephants.
Me and Louise Johns promised each other that we would go back and report on this story because it touched us in that way, and just it really upset me, and I think that that should be seen by the public.
Din dhal jaye hai raat na jaye तू तो ना आए तेरी याद सताए दिन ढल जाए हाय रात ना जाए.
So many stories end up like that, eating at you but not finished.
I really wanted to do more in-depth reporting on bicycling in big cities there, and even though I collected a lot, I still wanted more. More time, more space. There was this one woman who spoke to me, and she was just inspiring. I mean, she was this middle-aged woman and a championship cyclist. Now, this was in a city where cycling in those streets can absolutely get you killed, and women aren't really even supposed to bike. And on top of all that, she started biking in competition after her kids were grown and gone. Her name is Smita Patil.
If you feel you want to do something, do it, because your body, which is such a marvel, if it can conceive, if it can dream, if it can desire, if it can have a passion, it also will achieve it. So don't have an if I can, if this happens, do you think I don't have these questions, just do it, because you just have one life. If you can't live your life now, you will never be able to experience what is there in that life.
I just wish I could have done an entire feature on her alone. I mean, what about you, Allison? What pieces did you leave behind?
I left behind a paradise flycatcher. And it is the most beautiful bird I've ever seen in my entire life. And I was out there, I had my headphones, I had my recorder, we were tromping around in this like tropical jungle looking for birds. And we had gone out with this man who leads, you know, like adventure, like birding trips.
The way to identify the Ashi Drongo is the eyes. Look at the eye, it will have a red eye.
Oh.
And every time he'd see a bird, he'd be like, look, look, look.
There it is, there it is. There it is. Right in the open.
You know, he would point out this, you know, crested eagle, and there was this little, there's like a fan-tailed flycatcher, and its tail fans out like this, and it like flutters, and it looks like a little burlesque dancer. And it was beautiful and amazing, and I had all of this awesome tape, and I didn't use a single piece of it. And I don't know if I'll ever be able to. I mean, it might be like cool stuff that sits in my archive forever.
And I mean, that's sad. It's sad you couldn't put it in the pieces that we did produce. I mean, we each were able to produce a few things.
We were there for a month. So we reported all of our pieces, got back to Pune, and produced everything in that month. And we produced, each of us produced two feature-length pieces. And that was a lot of work in a few days. And so that's why we ended up leaving behind so many stories.
And if any of our listeners actually want to hear what any of us or the group that went with us produced, you can find it on umttoindia, that's with the number 2.com. Now, there comes a time when reporting these things that the reporting just does need to end.
There are just some stories that aren't meant to be public.
There's a time when the reporter needs to say to themselves,
okay, look,
this is private.
I can't go any further.
There's a point where it simply becomes exploitation.
I was doing a story on trash and garbage in Pune, and I was with my writer, And we were just kind of wandering around. We were actually going to get some food around lunchtime, and it was really hot outside. And this street that we were on was just so disgusting and just so, trying to think of a good word, but there's just trash everywhere and really, really just like smelly and disgusting and just your classic like kind of borderline slum street in India. And just, you know, people on the street, dirty, like children running around. But this is right in the middle of this city of Pune. And I had noticed this woman and child before we went into the restaurant where we were getting food. And I was so struck by this little girl that she was wearing this dress and she was with her mother just kind of wandering around and begging, trying to beg for money from people. And she caught my eye before we went in the restaurant. And then when we came back out, she was sitting in her mother's lap. We went by this stand, this like fried food stand or something, and she was sitting in her mother's lap, just laid across her mother's lap on this dirty, dirty sidewalk, and her dress was pulled up like kind of almost over her face, and I could see she wasn't wearing underwear, so I could see all of her private parts, and it was just seeing that, just almost, it broke my heart, really. I almost instantly started crying. But I had my camera with me, and I couldn't, like, my first instinct was not to take a picture. And I think like part of the reason in that situation, even though I was so struck by the moment, not to take a picture, my decision not to take a picture or think about it, was because it's like, we're both human, and what am I know that if I do anything with this picture, it could be a really good picture and end up somewhere, or it could be something that I keep, that just goes in my, you know, and on my archive or something. But there's something about the act of taking a photo and like that kind of connection with humanity that sometimes you just don't feel right taking a photo, and it's a moment that you yourself have to kind of you have to feel those moments yourself, and you don't need an image for that because it's too personal almost. I don't know. It's hard to grapple like something like that. It's hard to understand. I think our perception of it is so different because we're outsiders, and I haven't really seen anything like that before. So but other people walk by that every single day and it doesn't even faze them. To me, that was one moment where I was like, wow. And I couldn't take a picture at that moment.
Thanks for listening to In Other Words. This is Allison Mills and Madeline Beck, and we're talking today about what it is like to drop into India with other journalism students. We heard from Louise Johns and Kelsey Wardwell about their experience behind the lens as photojournalists.
And also talk with Michael Hannon about his troubles walking away from a story he wasn't able to write about.
But we haven't yet told you about some of the logistical roadblocks to going to India. Do you remember when Devin forgot to get on the plane?
I don't know what forgot is the correct way to put that, but you definitely overslept and didn't make it on the plane with the rest of us.
Yeah, or all of the equipment that we were promised in at Flame?
It turns out that people there really like to please, and they say yes even when they really mean no. So when we asked, oh, do you have computers that we can use that have equipment that we can use? And they said, yes, you can use everything. We have all the computers, they didn't have anything for us. We had to download free stuff from the internet. Still got her done.
Yeah. There's also some more typical things that you might think of that aren't necessarily reporter specific, but I remember getting lost on the rickshaws in Pune a couple of times and getting separated from our groups.
I mean, there's too many things to say that went wrong, even though we had many things that went right. So it would be an understatement to say there were problems.
Yeah, a few hiccups.
Challenges?
Hurdles, if you will.
And everyone had an opinion about it. I mean, we're a group of independent student journalists.
You know, the logistics of this operation, this trip to India, were pretty challenging. It's just a constant exercise in problem solving.
It was really challenging.
Because we were sort of like dropped in the middle of the situation, we had to...
Made it really difficult to get everything that I needed and everything that I wanted into my story.
Just overcoming my fear or tendency to want to sink back like into myself.
The most challenging part of our trip to India
was the food, because by the end I missed hamburgers and bacon and any kind of meat.
Seeing the pollution and environmental devastation there was really eye-opening.
Actually, something that was difficult.
As far as like getting dropped into things and just having to learn as you go.
And flying by the seat of your pants, I guess you could say.
And then we went back that evening to interview him for our story. And turns out he wasn't a fisherman, and that wasn't his family that we had tea with, and he was also the village drunk. So that was fun.
The group size, we had about, 20 to 30 white people walking around in India. You have a lot of attention.
The group size was probably a little bit
too big.
Too many people hindered our travel and what I feel like we could have done with exploring. And
the most challenging thing for me was
challenge and much more of a reporting experience.
Getting our translators to
say exactly what the interviewee is saying and regurgitate it word for word.
But just working around the different culture and being in a different place.
We were trying to talk to the receptionist and she didn't understand what we were saying, and I didn't understand what she was saying, so she ended up putting me on the phone, and I called somebody in Nagpur or Chandrapur and tried to explain to them what was going on, and they didn't understand what I was saying, and phone interviews are hard enough already, and when you're speaking different languages on the phone, it's impossible.
There's a lot of anxiety built into that. So there's a lot of unknown areas that you're kind of, I guess another analogy would be kind of a little minefield. You just don't know what you're going to be stepping into next. But, I think that's more than balanced out by the serendipity of discovery, the serendipity of whether it's a child's smile or the serendipity of the kind of aha moment that is not necessarily confined to scientists, but just sort of putting two and two together.
Things all of us in this particular study abroad were very aware of was our overwhelming group size.
The shoe size was its own problem. Here's Louise Johns again.
You can't form relationships when you're just this flock. It's hard, especially for photographers, I think, because we're kind of loners in a way, especially when we're working. But you really have to connect to it and not just be there watching. I think both of us struggled with that a lot, just being with a big group of Americans, because we automatically have a stereotype being a group of Americans, and people either love us or they have this automatic kind of want to push us away. I think it's just breaking down that stereotype and being, you know, really connecting as humans is what we have to do.
You know, it's like we get this chance to go to this place, and even though, I mean, that village of those people may never see another group of kids like us again, I mean, you can't leave a place with that kind of stereotype, and you really just have to build a relationship, not just for yourself, but for people who want to go do that in the future. I mean, you really just have to do that wherever you go. And I feel like that brings it even back to home, back to here.
That was Kelsey Wardwell, and she makes a great point. I mean, obviously, it wasn't just the group that put distance between us reporters and the people in our stories.
I mean, we were a herd of white kids.
And since most of us were coming from a Montana winter, very white.
It was like we were one of those Japanese tour groups that come to Glacier and they've got the big cameras and the American clothing. And when they climb off the bus, we all giggle. But in India, we were that group.
And that's strange for us. I mean, we were white Americans from white American suburbs and ranches.
And there were plenty of other things. What else did you guys notice that really set us apart?
Like when you're kind of walking around with your camera on the street, it's way easier to be seen as an outsider because, first of all, we're carrying around these $1,000 cameras that no one's seen before. A lot of these people have never seen before, and they're just staring at you. And it's like almost uncomfortable to be taking pictures. And you kind of have to like tread that line really in a really smart way.
Yeah, walking that line is about more than discretion and indiscretion. It's about walking the line between holding back and just taking.
Coming from such a dominant, aggressive culture, it's hard not just to want to take and take. And it's easy to forget that we just take. And that kind of cultural appropriation is not okay.
One of the biggest challenges is connecting with these people. And this includes just breaking these negative stereotypes and setting examples. It really just comes down to respect.
And establishing that respect is really hard when you don't speak one another's languages. As Michael Hannon, our print reporter in India, pointed out, just interviewing someone became a fiasco, especially when trying to find someone who, in Maharashtra, India, speaks Marathi or Hindi and can translate.
That was pretty much the biggest thing, is getting everything translated. That was the most time-consuming part, most tedious part. We always needed a translator. So the Flame students that we were with, we really depended on them. They set up pretty much everything, and then we would go and we would ask the questions and, you know, look into the people's eyes and ask them questions, and then obviously they had no idea what we were saying. So they would, you know, of course, translate for us.
I'm a poor man. From where will I get 1 to 2 lakhs rupees for getting myself a car?
Right. So this is Anshika Goel. She is a student of Flame University and one of our now good friends.
I mean, she and I would swap music and talk about our lives and how our mothers wanted us to get boyfriends.
I guess the challenge of language becomes more of a blessing in that way, because we all made friends while over there, and it really wasn't that difficult, to be honest, because we're all
so
people.
There is no issue.
No problem.
Even when we didn't have our translators with us, we could still bridge that gap on our own.
So Madeline and I, the very last day that we were in India, I hadn't got to go see any rock formations, and I have an undergrad in geology. And I was like, I am standing on the Deccan Plateau. I need to go see some rocks. And so Madeline and I actually snuck off campus.
Very forbidden, being two women on the campus. Can't leave the campus just as women. You have to have guys with you. But we were sneaky.
Yeah, so we snuck off campus, and we were going to go find some rocks. And we were wandering down the road, and we started seeing these, like, crystals, like, in the dirt path. And so we're, like, crouching down, like, digging at this, like, red dust, like, trying to uncover all these crystals.
And all these, like, really cool turquoise rocks and all these weird... And people were looking at us like we were insane. I mean, there were people going by with their cows just staring at these two white American women, like, what are you doing digging in the dirt?
And it was pretty funny. And I remember at one point we had passed this farmhouse and we both had, like, full hands of rocks. And this woman came out and she had this beautiful sari on. She had a baby on one hip and another little guy, like, kind of holding on to her knee. And she came out and she didn't speak a word of English. We don't speak a word of Marathi.
Well, we spoke a few words of Hindi, which she understood, but I could say, what is your name?
Right, that's right. And you taught me how to say beautiful that day, too, but I can't remember it now.
I can't even remember.
I have to go back to India. It'll come back. But yeah, we couldn't speak at all, but through, you know, a little bit of interpretive dance and showing her the rocks and, you know, kind of digging around, you know, we all laughed and giggled, but she got the point that we were looking for rocks and ended up just a little ways down the road, you know, we found that other woman.
Yeah, we found a complete other family. Especially this older grandmotherly woman came and she saw our rocks and she was adamant she had to show us this giant rock mountain behind her home. And so she dragged us along with her nieces, nephews, you know, daughters, sons, granddaughters, grandchildren, and was showing us all these rocks and asking us to take pictures. And we took so many pictures.
And we looked at so many rocks, and it was awesome because even though the rocks and the road were really cool, I mean, she took us up behind her house and showed us, like, boulders of zeolites. I mean, so for those of you who don't know what zeolite is, it's this very, very cool rock that forms when hot water basically slams into basalt, and it creates these huge, gorgeous crystals. And it's actually what that area of India is known for, these zeolites. And it is unreal walking up to this boulder, which is basically a giant crystal. And it's, like, crisscrossed with all this, like, turquoise weathering. And it was just beautiful. And it was amazing. And none of us spoke. I mean, we really couldn't communicate with each other. But we were all sitting there geeking out about rocks together. It was awesome.
Oh, it was great. One of the little boys would just go and show us everything. He'd take this. Allison ended up taking, like, what was it, like a 5-pound boulder home with her in her suitcase. Yeah, there you go. But, you know, it was true. We were two women on our own on an old dirt road in the middle of India. This is, again, against the rules of the college we were staying at, to leave without a male escort.
And for a lot of people, that really is a very serious fear that people have, you know, traveling abroad, you know, journalist or not. When I got back to the States in the Minneapolis airport, I had a couple of guys help me find a payphone. And when I asked them, well, they asked where I had been traveling. And when I said India, they were like, oh, I hope you weren't traveling by yourself, young lady.
Yeah, it was the same with my mother. It's just a big fear people have about women, especially when traveling abroad. I mean, it's not unwarranted. The recent rape cases in India have brought that to light.
So Kelsey and Louise, as female photojournalists who like to work alone, how do you feel about this?
I definitely think, like, as females, we have to protect ourselves more. And there are certain things that, yeah, like, especially in a place like India, they're being a woman is, they see women really differently than we do in America, and maybe not as equal. But a lot of it, you really just kind of have to stand your ground and just be respectful, but try not to come off as being, like, intimidated mm-hmm. by the fact that you're a female.
There was definitely times, especially walking around Pune, where you're just surrounded by a million people and I'm, like, sweating, like, clutching onto my camera and kind of being like, all right, I can't lose sight of my partner over there. And, I mean, there's times, I mean, not even just as a reporter, but, and not even just as a female, but as a human, that it was kind of scary just to be there. We all like had to dress pretty modestly, which wasn't like an issue, but you definitely are kind of like, can't wear this. Like, all right, I'm going to go tell this story. And just, you kind of have to put on your poker face, and not all the time. And I thought I was going to be a lot more nervous than I was, but I mean, there was only a very small handful of scenarios where I got a little panicked.
I mean, there's the safety factor, which is, I think it's true for a lot of foreign countries. Like, you know, girls shouldn't travel alone, and that's kind of just a sad truth. But I was just treated, men were treated better. I went to this place, just like this touristy kind of shopping street area, and I went and I bought a couple of tapestries, and the guy's like, okay, that's 40 rupees. I'm like, okay, whatever. Like, I tried to barter, but he wouldn't budge. And then the girls that were with me, right after, he said, like, it was like 150 rupees. And I mean, something like that. It was at least twice what I paid, and I just found that kind of sad. But, and maybe it was because they're American girls and they know they love to shop and they'll spend money on things, but they did make an effort to segregate the boys and the girls at the school. You're not allowed in each other's rooms. The students told me that they weren't technically allowed to hug each other. They couldn't enforce it too well because, you know, you did see that stuff because it's college kids. What are you going to do? The older generations definitely still keep that. When we also, this is more from a religious standpoint, but when we went to this giant temple in Nagpur, they kind of brought us in as guests of honor. And the four or five guys that were there in the group, we got to be in the front and, like, right in front of this awesome gold room. And then the girls were all the way in the back, and I don't think they were too happy about that, but we felt pretty special, us guys.
Also, sometimes it can be beneficial to be a woman, a lot of times, actually, not just sometimes, but people, because they view women differently, and this isn't just in India, sometimes they're more accepting of women, and sometimes our presence is more gentle and more comfortable.
Yeah, I feel like women sometimes just have presence that is a lot different than what
different
men can
approach.
Have. Yeah, and I feel like it's like a woman-to-woman thing. Like, you know, if I was, like, mm-hmm. wanting to take this woman's photo, and I kind of, you could just, like, kind of feel, like, the eye contact and nod and just kind of like, yeah, I respect you. Like, we're from different places, but we're both here. that's kind of
just
weird.
Unintimidating.
Yeah.
We don't have that aggressive presence that maybe some men do, and just as women photographers, we don't come off as being that way.
That's just as a photographer, you kind of just have to be approachable anyway, but
women photographers are so important to have.
I feel like it's like us, even just our small group of girls going to this place and kind of being like, hey, like, we are female reporters and doing what we're doing. It's probably a small progressive impact, but it is a way to break those gender barriers around the world. I mean, it kind of just slowly knocks away that wall that's built up. I think that's what makes things change.
जग उठी है घर की नारी उदित नया दिन कर हो संस्कारों के पुष्प खिले जागृति नव घर घर में हो शक्ति स्रोत बने अंतर ज्योत जले शक्ति स्रोत अंतर ज्योत जले हो मजबूत इरादा हर पल आगे अब बढ़ना है एक एक कर हमको निश दिन प्रगति शिखर चढ़ना है मिल जाए मंजिल मन
So for Luis, one of her biggest inspirations is her dad, who is the editor-in-chief at National Geographic. And Luis learned a lot about photography from him, but she also learned a lot more.
A lot of who I am comes from my dad, I think. My dad is one of the biggest influences in my life. And he himself is a very gentle person. And and just the way he approaches things, he's just calm. And I kind of feel like I try to be like my dad. And I feel like I've learned so much from him, just despite his experiences as a male photographer and mine just like so early in my career is as a female. I think he still has so much to share and offer me, and we can understand each other. I mean, there's not really a gender line, I think, and it can be that way for everyone, you know, not just father-daughter. There doesn't need to be a gender difference.
आशाओं के कभी बुझ न पाए,
कभी आंधियां जो आके को बुझाए।
So now in the course of this hour-long Behind the Lens special for Another Words,
about reporting that's done behind the pictures and behind the published story,
we've covered a lot of really deep, heavy stuff.
Like, I don't know, abused animals, poor living conditions, and the fears we experience just by being reporters.
And to be honest, those dark parts are what made some of those best moments even better.
One word about India that describes what your favorite thing about India was.
It's tea.
Tea.
Music. The sunshine. Jokes. Food.
Food.
Home cooked Indian meal, and we were singing songs.
One thing I'm thankful for the trip is just like the friendship.
We were really far away from home, but meeting the people there, we had so much in common.
My favorite moment was when I was working on my second story. I got to talk to this super cool 50-year-old woman who was just, I'm gonna kind of sort and say a badass, and just bicycled all over the place and was just motivated and an inspiring person to talk with.
My favorite moment would probably have to be
tigers.
Actually seeing a tiger.
A tiger could be 12 feet away from me or less, and we wouldn't know.
Going into the tiger reserve on these safaris was really just kind of an unreal experience.
When that gypsy in front of us turned around and yelled, like, you know, oh, baka, 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 like, tiger, tiger, tiger.
When I saw the tiger, I felt really
sort of visceral reactions I had to the presence of tigers.
I didn't feel like tense, but
really, really excited. So I was like super tense, and I was like standing in the Jeep, and
this sort of feeling came over me of
hair on the back of my neck.
Awe and amazement at this animal.
And then it walked right past our Jeep.
And watching it move, like seeing the muscles in its shoulders just like rippling underneath the fur and its giant paws.
Really an amazing experience. My favorite moment would probably have to be
I had a tiger come about 10 feet away from me and I got to take some sweet pictures.
Okay, so now Kelsey's favorite moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
This is kind of a strange moment, and I don't know if it's like pure joy, but it was a moment where I realized I had made a connection and that someone was wanting us to be there. But Corn and I were doing a multimedia piece on the doctor there, the village doctor, and his name was Dr. Gupta. one day Corn and I were kind of just walking around, and he was supposed to be gone in another village, Dr. Gupta was. And we were walking by the school, and Dr. Gupta, like, came out of his little two-bedroom office, and he's like, oh, come in, come in. And we were like, okay. And I luckily had my camera with me, but he's like, no, no, come inside, come inside. And I was like, can I take? He's like, yes, yes, photos. And I was like, okay. We go in there and we see these two men lying on two little hospital beds and like three other people. And one man is holding one of the guy on the hospital bed's head shut because he had a tree fall on his head and split his head open. And he just had this huge gash in his head. And I was like, oh my God, I can't take photos of this. This is against the law. But then I'm like, oh, I'm in India. Like, they'll let me do it. And he wasn't wearing gloves. They like just took a needle out of a little box, and it was just all very, you know, looked like casual. He was like sewing a shirt together. And I never, I don't know. And then they like went out, him and his assistant, the doctor and the assistant went out back and like poured hot water over the utensils and kind of let him sit there. And it was like, all right. And they pulled down the guy's pants at one point to like give him a shot in the butt. I was like, okay, I'm not going to take a photo of that. I think Corn and I were both just like, we both just kept looking at each other like, is this really happening? Taking photos of someone getting their head stitched together. I'm sure it was a little uncomfortable for the patient, but it was just, I really felt like he was excited to have us tell his story. They were totally happy to have us there, and it was just the weirdest thing, but really great.
So appearances might paint a place as sad because there are a lot of children without shoes, or unhappy because there are just so many people living in one place.
But as it turns out, joy can really be found anywhere.
I mean, Kelsey found it in a doctor's office during surgery.
And Louise, she loved being in India. And
just seeing the joy in the children and the joy in a lot of people. Like, there's actually a lot of joy in that place. The worst thing, actually, I think that we can do as outsiders is to come there and just have pity for them because they don't want pity. Pity isn't helping anything. I mean, being at that school with those children and seeing how happy they are in their life, even though they have an eighth of what I do and they live in a dirt road village, but they live in a beautiful village. They live right outside a tiger reserve. They live next to tigers. I mean, tigers are some of the coolest creatures on earth. And yeah, there's so much joy there and happiness and beauty. Seeing the joy and the beauty in places like that is just as important as seeing the tragedy.
I mean, that's what India was and is. It's a place where there can be a three-story high-class shopping mall right next door to a plot of dirt where a family has made a home under a tarp and sells fruit out of it.
And that family is often happier than those people in the mall.
I mean, we went with goals, an aim, a purpose. Most journalists do.
But like most who report abroad, we ended up with more information than we could handle.
But it's that information that makes us better able to connect, better able to listen and understand.
Kind of give and take impact on each other's lives. It's like maybe you don't always impact the people you're with, but I just picture all the children there and how excited they were to have their photos taken. And they just like were like, ma'am, photo please. Like they finally like learned how to ask us and it was so sweet. And it's like, I will always remember them. I remember their faces. I remember everything about them. And it's like, I hope that they're like, all right, these people are pretty nice and not, you know, and they kind of have a better outlook on the world than what maybe we stepped in with that they saw. I mean, it's hard to like be there and take some photos and leave. It's hard like not knowing if you're going to ever see someone again, but you just have to be a human. Everyone needs that to know someone cares about them in the world.
Even if that's just sitting in the village listening to a kid's story, listening to a child tell their story, that made a difference in that person's life. Because how many people from another country, from the outside, come and will just sit there and listen to them? You know, being a photographer isn't just about taking pictures. It's really about helping people and just bringing awareness. And sometimes it's through photographs. Sometimes it's just through listening to somebody and letting them be who they are and be comfortable with who they are. And then you start taking pictures and then you get the most powerful, beautiful, poignant pictures. Whether you get any photographs or anything from your travels or experiences like that, you can still change somebody's life, and that makes a difference in the world. Louise learned that a photographer has to be more than just a photographer. They have to be human, too. Alexander Didi is a print reporter that went with us to India, and he found out about what's really behind the writing.
When you read a story in National Geographic, or you look at a photo, or any international reporting, you look at it and you sort of think as a reporter, like, I could do that, or I could do that one day, you know, not that I think I could go out right now and write a story that's quality of National Geographic, but that I would eventually be capable of that. And going over there and actually working in their sort of footsteps, trying to do what they're doing, gave me a lot more respect for international reporting, because it's incredibly difficult. And we were on a set up scheduled trip with other people and translators lined out ahead of time. I can only imagine going over there by myself, or by myself and another reporter or photographer. And it's I definitely have a lot more respect for people who do it all the time.
Work was the man with the
absolutely insane
plan to take a huge group of college students,
many of whom had never left the country,
on a plane ride of over 30 hours across the globe to a place completely foreign to us.
Turns out he did have some pretty good reasoning, though.
Well, I must have been crazy. My idea was to take some students to India, because it's just such a far-out extreme place, and I thought that it would be a really cool experience for students, especially those who hadn't ever been out of the U.S., to go to a country that is so different, so strange, so unusual, and so fascinating. You know, the scholastic purpose was only part of it, a small part of it, I thought. Really, the experience of being there and of navigating your way around, of solving problems on almost a minute-to-minute basis, that was the experience that I was hoping to share. I wanted students to have basically more confidence in their ability to turn a story under difficult circumstances. If you can do it in India, you can do it just about anywhere. If you can conceive, plan, report, and write or produce a story in a country like India, you know, the sky's the limit. It's kind of self-evident when you find a story. You know, it just kind of smacks you in upside the face. It's a human connection with an issue or an event, and it's something that is part of a narrative, and you know that that's a story that is important to you and probably is going to be important to a lot of other people. It's something that's worth telling. So India is India. India is unpredictable. India is full of a lot of challenges, language, geography, climate, culture, religion even, and you have to navigate your way through a lot of different levels. What's the story I'm looking for, and who are my sources, and how am I going to find them, and good Lord, how am I going to talk to them? All of those things were logistical problems that we all had to solve in order to find a subject to interview. The first thing that you will notice if you are a breathing human being is that the person across from you is probably pretty different from almost anybody you've ever seen before, or existing in a different environment. And if you communicate with that person, you've begun to build a little bit of a bridge, a little bit of closing that gap. You know, if the next person that you're interviewing is a prisoner in Deer Lodge or something, that's maybe not such a completely shocking or different experience than it might have been before. you know, it's kind of a cliche, but it broadens your mind. You come to understand different ways of living, different ways of thought, different ways of dress and habit, and you understand that you're a part of a larger world. I think we succeeded in that.
I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Allison Mills.
And you've been listening to our broadcast of Behind the Lens
from Montana Public Radio's In Other Words. Thanks for listening.